You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Why am I with Seabus Super?
Because I'm a builder and they take care of me.
Well, I had an accident on the work site and they helped me out, no worries.
Yeah, they helped me out real fast.
Mate, they just get me.
Because they are for all of us.
Seabus, for all of us. To consider if Seabus is right for you, visit seabussuper.com.au for a copy of the PDS.
I had to go about it, write it out and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you.
This is The Final Word with Jeff Lemon and the very late night live version of Adam Collins. This is 2 a.m. Adam Collins. You've never had this Adam Collins potentially before. I just arrived back from the last T20 match in the series down in Southampton on the long drive back. Has made it back to London. I'm feeling bright and morning fresh, and I will try to nurse you, Adam, through the next hour or so of the show. Good evening.
Good evening. Good morning. Yes, I predictably made two wrong turns on the way back, for I am tired, but it's okay because I am also prepared, and that's more important than being alert. So hopefully that will make for a good conversation. We have plenty to talk about. I know that because the T20 series finished tonight and it ended in, I think, a good way as far as those of us who love Mitch March, who was the player of the match in the final game, held his nerve at the end. It looks like the wheels might fall off again, but it was Marsh and Agar who perhaps just as importantly, in a way, given they're trying to teach him how to play this number seven role. And it was Marsh who obviously scored more heavily than Agar. But as far as the longer term, how are they going to set this team up? They really want Agar to partner Zampa. And that he was there at the end and that he made runs on Sunday and that he took wickets each time. Really good catch today as well off his own bowling. I think that overall he'll be pretty happy with his output.
Yeah, it looked like throughout the series that it was tough on Agar. He got targeted quite a bit when he was bowling. There was a lot of questions around him at number seven. England were dominant through the first couple of games. I didn't watch every ball of it because a lot of it was on between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m., although I did see probably more of it than I anticipated during those hours. But you watched all of it very closely. And the initial stages, you know, the first couple of games, it felt like that 2018 one-day tour when Australia went over there and England just had absolutely no problems at all knocking them over. But I suppose in terms of the ODIs ahead as well, it's good that Australia clawed back into it a bit and managed to get a consolation win even with some personnel changes for England.
Yeah, and some personnel changes for Australia as well. They won without Warner and Cummins, who they rested. And I thought what Finch said at the toss was fairly interesting, that they know they're going from bubble to bubble to bubble to bubble, really. I mean, the schedule, the Australian schedule is going to be released probably later in the week, and we have a fairly decent idea now what it'll look like with one day as followed by the test matches against India, followed by potentially a test against Afghanistan at the end. But no matter what the configuration is and what cities they play in all probability, they're going to be locked away in some version of a bubble, which will mean that it's mentally taxing. That's the message that's been received loud and clear from those who have been involved. I mean, Joss Butler took a day off today. I mean, it's his 30th birthday. I think that was lost in the coverage to an extent, why he would want to be away. But he hasn't seen his family for 10 weeks because when he was out of the bubble, his family were away coincidentally. So I kind of understood what Finch was saying when he said, we've got senior players who are three-format players. We're going to give them a chance to sort of not play when it's not essential. And that was what they saw today. But Hazelwood walks into the team, hadn't played a T20 international since that night when Coley somehow beat them, needing to go at 15 and over in that World T20 game in 2016. That was Josh Hazelwood's last T20 international. And he bowled superbly. Three overs in the power play, picked up Banton early. It was hard to get away. No real tricks about what he's doing, but if you bowl at his pace and as accurately as he does, you know, with all the other variables that he brings to play, like his height and so on, he's always going to be a handful. And then Stark bowled the best that he bowled in the series today, which I don't think it's a coincidence that Stark with Hazelwood, they tend to bowl really nicely together. And then the other seamer, Kane Richardson, you fold him in, and the three of them went at collectively 6.16 runs and over. They all took an important wicket. And I think that, you know, alongside Cummins, you've got your four there, don't you? That'll be the squad of four, which they want to have working towards the two World Cups in 2 years.
We have to talk in some detail about the Australian choke in the first game, one of the all-time chokes. What was it? They needed 39 from 36 at the end with how many wickets left? 8 wickets in hand, was it?
I think it was 39 from 38 at one stage as well, because there was a couple of dots at the end of that over. But yeah, it was bizarre to be... I was on air for the last 5 overs, which from memory I picked up when Adil Rashid took his 2 wickets in and over. And, you know, I listened back to bits of that the other day in the TMS podcast, and my tone at the start is like, I mean, I'm kind of bemused by the whole thing. I'm like, oh, this is an interesting little thing, and not even a twist. Yeah. It's like,
funny.
They've lost a couple of wickets. And to go behind, the curtain a bit, as we do usually, I had already written my match report for the Sydney Morning Herald. All I was going to do was fill in the gaps to simply note that Australia had won by 9 wickets. Warner and Smith, the two men who had made it through to the finish line. Of course, I would have, you know, elaborated in that report a little bit later, but my first cut was going to be just, you know, noting the very obvious
comfortable victory.
The textbook victory that was set up by the bowlers and the excellent captaincy of Aaron Finch and the way that he swung the changes and so on and so on. And then, you know, massive rewrite required the minute I got off air as the game, you know, sort of drifted away from Australia. Well, not even drifted. It was more abrupt than that. And then at the end with Stoinis, who I felt really sorry for at the time, because all we've heard from the Australian camp in the lead up to the series was that they didn't see Stoinis as a finisher. They thought that he was, you know, best used at the top of the order or inside the power play. And we saw tonight that he remains very well suited to the power play. Struck 5 boundaries in the first 6 overs after coming in when Wade got out. I think he struck 5 boundaries, and I think 4 of them were in the 2 overs that he had left in the power play when he walked out to the middle. So again, it reinforces that point that that's where he's best positioned in this T20 team. But he was sent out as the finisher in the first game, which doesn't suit his skill set, and it kind of backfired. And meanwhile, Mitchell Marsh, who has been playing that role for the Scorchers and indeed did play that role tonight, was omitted. And it felt like a strange one for me, given that Marsh was the incumbent and Stoinis was the new man in. But yeah, they got it right in the end. It just took them a couple of games to get there, if you know what I mean, in terms of the balance of the side. And I guess the interesting one, I'm not sure if you caught up with this either, Jeff, but Matthew Wade, he wasn't just rotated in for Alex Carey. I mean, Finch made it pretty clear that Carey had been omitted. And when you consider that Alex Carey is the player they not only think will keep for the test team and all three formats long term, I mean, he's kind of talked up as the next captain, really, isn't he? And that he will now have to earn his spot back. And Matt Wade only made, I think, 16. But inside that 16, he smashed Jofra Archer for one of the biggest sixes you'll ever see, which kind of reasserted Australia in the power play after Archer and Wood got on top of them on Sunday. It was a really important sort of moment in time, which helped, you know, get them in the right zone to take on Archer. And they extracted 25 runs from his first 2 overs, which, you know, meant they had a big power play.
I think what we see with Stoinis is that thing that we see so often with picking national T20 squads out of domestic competitions, which is that the best players across a domestic comp all bat at the top of the order.
Yeah,
you know, you've got your best cricketers will open, your best batters will open, or bat 3 at worst, meaning that they make piles of runs as an opener. They make a case that they can't be left out. They have to be picked, got to go to India because, you know, he's made 600 runs in the last domestic tournament. And then you end up with half a dozen openers and, like, what are you supposed to do with them? And you don't – nobody in a domestic comp, it's very rare that people actually play a dedicated finishing role at six or seven. Or if they do, they don't make the piles of runs that get them picked. You know, they make very important 20s or 30s off, you know, 22 off 12 balls or whatever it might be. But they don't do the job that actually gets them picked in the team. And so then you end up with these unbalanced squads. And we've seen it time and time again in the way that national squads have been picked in T20 cricket.
Yeah, I touched on Agar a moment before. And look, Agar isn't a finisher. But it was interesting hearing him talk on, I think it was Sunday or Monday, about how he wants to become a dependable number seven in a side that, I mean, it's clear they are going to play five specialist bowlers in the World Cup. I mean, there's no way they'd be doing it as often as they are if that wasn't their plan A. I mean, Stoinis and Mitchell Marsh didn't bowl an over between them in the whole series. Glenn Maxwell bowled a couple in the second game, and I think he bowled two or three in the first game. Really important overs too, by the way, as well. Good captaincy from Finch to identify that matchup against the left-handers, where Maxwell has an average of sort of 15 compared to 50-odd against right-handers. But I digress. The point is that if you're going to have five bowlers and Agar definitely at seven, you better have a good player at six. Or should I say, a player that's suited to the role at six. And we know that now. Mm. The data bears that out, that you're only going to face sort of in the vicinity of, in an ordinary T20, maybe 12 to 15 balls, and you need to make it count. And you also need the other club in the bag, which is that you can get your team out of trouble if they, you know, and that's kind of what Mitchell Marsh walked into tonight when he was in there at 87 for four, and then it was 100 for five with seven overs to go when Agar joined him. He needed to do sort of two things. He needed to both steady the ship and also score at a decent clip, and he took Mark Wood down eventually, and that was the turning point in the game.
But for Stoinis, that's never been his strength. He's coming in to score from ball one. He doesn't necessarily do that, and I've shared this hypothesis with you that almost the worst thing that happened to Marcus Stoinis was making that amazing 100 in Auckland, where he hit 10 sixes and made a 150 odd not out and nearly won them a game from nowhere, because he came in that game with most of the innings to go after they were five or six for bugger all. And he played that amazing innings, but all that anyone remembers is Marcus Stoinis hit a lot of sixes. And so they keep expecting him to be able to do that. But we saw in the World Cup last year, he really struggles to get going at times, particularly in the middle overs when the field's back and they're bowling spin and all the rest of it. And where he's looked good has been coming out and opening facing seam with the field up, and it's just a very different job.
Yeah, your analysis is spot on about usually the best T20 players at domestic level will bat in the top three or four. And look, Stoinis, the best comparison is Chris Gayle in terms of the strike rate in the first 5-10 balls and how he plays himself in before sort of teeing off. And there's clearly a role for that player in T20 cricket. The question is, where does Stoinis fit when you've got Finch and Warner, who are obviously going to open?
Yeah.
Does he bat three with Smith four and Maxwell five? Okay, well, that's not a problematic balance. That's probably a pretty good balance. But a lot of the time, they'll want to have the scope to have Maxwell being at least named at four. I know he's had a poor series by his standards. He failed twice and made 23 in the game in the middle, with the game they lost and didn't make enough runs, and where Maxwell was doing a bit of a patch-up job. But, yeah, so really when it all boils down to, when you kind of scale it all back, we know that five could work together. And now that Carey's out of the five, incidentally, that's quite interesting if they want to back in Matthew Wade for a period of time in that role, whether he might. I mean, he was doing the Maxwell job when Maxwell was injured in South Africa. But anyway, that's by the by. The actual finisher role, when Marsh was asked tonight about it in his press conference, he said something like, and I thought this quote was quite instructive. I put it into my report. He was thinking about it while he was batting. He's like, how much he loves the pressure of having to win the game for Australia, and how he really enjoys the idea of the expectations are that he will do it, and that, you know, he doesn't resolve from it. He takes the alternate view that it's super exciting, that he can be the match winner. And that's probably the personality that you need. And he's been around long enough now, Mitch Marsh. He made his debut. I didn't realise this. He played his first T20 international back in 2011, back in Johannesburg. So that's, even though he's only played 15 of them, it's not as though he's been around for 5 minutes. He should be, by definition, a senior player in his team right now. And to that end, I think that, you know, again, it might have taken them three games to get there, but Marsh at six has certainly earned an opportunity when India came out in a couple of months.
It's kind of interesting that there's almost the same shifting around of the tiles in the England team, where they've had Joss Butler being their finisher, you know, known as someone who can come in and make 30 off 10 at the end, but he's now a player who's made himself indispensable as an opener in T20 internationals because he's just so good from the get-go. And we saw that through this series where he only played the two matches but was supreme.
He averages 111 at the Aegeus Bowl in four T20 internationals at a strike rate of like a million. And his strike rate opening now, I think it dropped to 159 on Sunday when he was mounted the match. And, you know, after making... It managed to drop in that position despite how important that innings was. It was the slowest he's ever batted in a power play when he got out the other end of it, which I think, again, was interesting because it was a small chase and he modulated his game accordingly because he's a fucking superstar and he can do what he wants. But, yeah, good problem to have in a way because when Roy comes back, it'll be Roy, Bairstow and Butler vying for the two opening spots and all three of them obviously will want to do it. Bairstow made a half century today. Roy, his body of work speaks for itself in 20 over cricket. So whether they just pop Joss back to number six because that's the best fit or they might play all three of them in the similar way to what I'm saying with Finch, Warner, Stoinis, maybe they go, well, look, we'll effectively play three openers, if you like, and then in the same way that Smith will then be there at number four as the, you know, the glue in the middle, that can kind of be Milan, who, again, his record's fairly ridiculous in that role, or Joe Root, if they choose to go the other way, but it feels like they're backing in Milan more and more, and his numbers would you know, support that as well. And then you're right, though. Their problem is who's going to bat number six because they're going to play more often than not. They're going to balance up now, it seems anyway, with that five-bowler formulation. So Chris Jordan was coming in at number seven today, for example. So
This series, which just looked too early
yeah.
the time. You know, you look at a team sheet and see Jordan at seven. I mean, honestly, a team sheet with Agar at seven is more convincing to me than one with Jordan at seven.
But it's the future, isn't it? Like, I mean, I suppose the difference in 50 over cricket is that often you'll need Liam Plunkett walking in at number 10, you know, because or whoever else it was in that England lower order that made them so strong, because often you will need, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 players to make runs in a one-day international. In T20 cricket, they're banking on the idea that the most of the work will be done by the top five and then a bit by six and maybe a little bit by seven so they can get away with that mixture. But, I mean, Joe Denley was playing in that role today and he won't obviously be playing in the World Cup next year barring some very unusual set of circumstances with injuries and form and so on. But Sam Billings is the guy they want for that, right? And Billings has made... really no runs in the four opportunities he's had this summer in T20 cricket, all the four games he's played against Pakistan and getting back into the team today when he essentially replaced Owen Morgan. So, yeah, that they're in a similar boat.
And why did Morgan miss? Because they had Moeen captaining tonight.
Yes.
Which was nice to see, but Morgan missed out.
Yeah, so Morgan had dislocated his finger, which is the one he hurt last year. He did it again on Sunday.
Oh, the one he did in the... was that the one he injured before the warm-up game against Australia where he sat that one out?
That's right. That's spot on. Yeah, so the same finger, which he hurt it on Sunday and was there was like a five-minute delay or something like that, but he still came out and batted and whatever, but they took the precautionary route given they've got the one day is coming up. But yeah, so Moeen Ali captaining England for the first time was interesting. He's had an interesting series across the board, really. He seldom bowled. I think there was some stat that Zoltz had that, or maybe it was Ben Jones or maybe it was both of them, that he's bowled before tonight. He'd bowled 10 overs in 2019 in T20 cricket, never more than two in an innings, and eight of the 10 had been in the power play. So, in other words, the Moeen Ali from 2 or 3 years ago, who was, you know, the second spinner, more in a more traditional sense of the word, the second spinner and bowling, you know, four overs alongside Adil Rashid, that's kind of gone now. And he bowled himself for one over tonight in the middle overs, actually quite a good one. I think it only went for six or seven. But generally speaking, he's now playing as a bat. And that was actually quite an important moment in tonight's game where Mitchell Starc bowling to Moeen Ali, who was on 23 but just hit a six, and Steve Smith took a catch right on the rope. One of those ones where when they were going on the replay back and forth, toggling to determine whether Smith's heel had touched the rope or not. It could have gone either way, but had Moeen been there for the last five overs, they probably make, you know, 10 more runs, let's say. Instead, it was a bit of a limp finish and Australia were only chasing 146 and, you know, that was never going to be too much after the openers when the number three in Stoinis got off to a pretty good start.
Yeah, it does make me wonder, the thing you mentioned earlier with David Milan versus Joe Root, whether the deciding factor in that might be, you know, that Root has... had his struggles in Test cricket, and maybe just the idea of him being an all-format player is something that the selectors decide for him, that he's not really going to be that, rather than him having to make that decision himself. You know, often players in the middle of their careers find it hard to actually, you know, make that call to actually say no to a particular form of cricket.
Yeah, and I wonder whether, yeah, it's a funny time in the cycle, really, because you consider that the last T20 World Cup, it'll be 5 years between T20 World Cups and two in a year. And remember when the last T20 World Cup was on in 2016, they were going to this four-year cycle, and that did kind of lend itself to, you know, the bad old days of one T20 being popped on the end of a, you know, of an ODI series. And then over the years, we've kind of got to this status quo of three T20s. And now that the one-day Super League started, they'll seldom be more than three one-day internationals played in a series, which is a good thing. So we'll probably see them balanced out with three and three more often. But, yeah, I kind of wonder whether... Well, a couple of things about the sort of broader T20 international setting, which I think is worth sort of putting out there. One is that having a third team involved where you can, adding a third person to the relationship to spice things up a little bit, I think where it's possible to do it, and it, again, I've raised that example of Zimbabwe a number of times where we were there a couple of years ago, and you can play every day in that scenario, provided you're at the same ground, like we were at the Aegeus Bowl this week, but you can play an entire tri-series in 7 days. And we've just had, you know, a three-game series played in 5 days. Two of those days, the players were sort of in the hotel and, you know, without sort of breaking confidences or anything like that. Not that there's any confidences to break, but we're just not meant to really reflect on what they're doing in their personal time. But the guts of it is that they're just fucking around like we are. And whatever it is they're doing in their games room, and it doesn't really seem like an efficient use of time. I understand why if you're moving from city to city, but I think like we might have stumbled upon with, you know, albeit in the biosecure kind of COVID land way of thinking of it, but if you play a T20 series at one venue and you do rope in a third team and you play 7 games in 7 days, I think that will be when we really start seeing this format of the game at international level take the next step, rather than just kind of bilateral series without any broader organising structure. I didn't even mention the fact that Australia went back to number one in the world tonight. England overtook them on Sunday, then Australia overtook them again tonight. And you know why? Because it doesn't really matter that much. Because across the board, there's not enough T20 international cricket played for that to mean a tremendous amount. But yeah, I think into the future, I'd like to see some more flexibility when it comes to scheduling around playing games in consecutive days, one, and two, where at all possible, having a third side. So whether that means, you know, I wonder whether the Chappell Hadley Trophy, which you and I have been to a number of times in the last 4 or 5 years in Australia and in New Zealand, well, now the one-day Super League's in position, I doubt they'll play one day as against New Zealand every year, because why would they? Where's the time? Instead, why not have a T20 tournament to start at summer? Why not have a seven-day T20 tournament between Australia, New Zealand, and a third country, like an invitational, which, you know, one year it's hosted in New Zealand, the other year it's hosted in Australia. You know, maybe whoever wins the games, the Trans-Tasman games, can take the Chappell Hadley Trophy as well. And that can be like a really sort of good focal point to start the white ball season and have a bit more meaning around it, rather than, you know, what we've had in the past, which has been, like I say, kind of it can often be an afterthought, even though it's had more of an emphasis in the last couple of years.
We mentioned Jos Buttler being consistent in his game. One thing that I was very pleased to see that a consistency has remained is that he's still drifting out of his crease as the bowler delivers. I saw some side-on photography work of Jos being definitely past his ground as the ball came out of the bowler's hand. Has not learned a single thing after all of his controversies. And that led us during the week to a nice moment when the Afghanistan international Daulat Zadran produced a beautiful run out of the non-striker, in that people say it doesn't involve skill. This one involved skill, because he really got in, you know, onto the bowling crease and had then realised the non-striker was about 3 metres out of his ground, just drifting away down the pitch. And Daulat Zadran wasn't within reach of the stump, so he had to turn around and throw back and clipped the bails with his throw and effected this run out. Now, I've been a Dorlat Zadran fan since the 2015 World Cup. Mm. He's the player who got out towards the end of that run chase and got abused off the field by his batting partner, Samuel Ishinwari, who just shouted at him all the way off. and since then, I've followed Dorlat Zadran's career quite closely. He ran out his Afghanistan teammate, Anur Ali Zadran, in the Shpagiza League, which is one of the more satisfying leagues to say. But, you know, it's nice to see that happen again, and that made me think of Joss. And I thought that Dorlat Zadran should be our CBUS Super Performer of the Week. I doubt you'll take issue with that.
No, I won't at all. I mean, Dorlat Zadran, I remember bowling that lovely spell at the start of the World Cup game against Australia where I think he picked up Finch early on. Oh,
against Warner.
Yeah, he bowled really nicely to Warner, and he got Finch. I think it was Finch who got out early on, and you're thinking, gee, Afghanistan might be on here. Press fast forward 2.5 hours, and Australia have made like 400, and Warner's made 180 of them or something ridiculous. But his first spell was lovely. And yes, I think he should be a CBUS Super Performer of the Week. CBUS manage over $50 billion of members' money, and their average return over the last 35 years is 9.23%.
Woohoo! I would invest $50 billion into more runouts of the non-striker if I had access to those sort of funds.
CBUSSuper.com.au. Get yourself a product disclosure statement from the website. You know that past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. You also know that CBUS Super have been outstanding supporters of what we try and do week in, week out with The Final Word. So if you are interested in working with them and moving your superannuation to them or any of the other financial services that they support their members with, drop along to cbussuper.com.au. A couple of bits and pieces before we move off the T20 short form stuff, Jeff. Jofra Archer and Mark Wood spell to start the power play. Now, this is on Sunday, I mean, where extraordinary barrage of pace to begin. Warner's out for his first duck since 2012 in that form of the game. I mean, an unplayable delivery. He reviewed it, and I kind of get it because you watch it. Both feet are off the ground. It's a mess of limbs, and the ball sort of sneaks through and kisses the glove on the way, and that's shown to be the case on Hotspot. But it wasn't just that, though. It was the way that Wood bowled to Carey. It was the way that Jofra went on to beat Finch several times before he kind of got set. For all the talk of England missing a left armer in the power plays, and I think they do. I mean, Andy Zaltzman, again, who we've been working with, he worked out that at the other end of the innings, in terms of the death overs, that 7 of the 10 best economy rates in the death over the 7 biggest T20 leagues, so a lot of cricket being played across those high-profile T20 leagues, are from left-arm seamers in terms of their economy rate. So we know that at the death they work, and we know up front that David Willey has been able to take a lot of wickets with the white ball, but England are going a different way. They're just going raw power. They're just going, more power with Wood and Archer, and it was fucking exciting. Whether it's sustainable long-term and whether it's sustainable in India, time will tell. But that was pretty cool. And and
Max Power. Yeah. You don't snuggle with Max Power, you strap in and feel the G's. let's play a very brief, a little game, just a little fun game between you and me, because I know it's late and I know you're tired. We'll make this quick, but it'll let us stretch our brain muscles as we get into a short aerobic round of Nerd Pledge. Nerd Pledge, the game of nerds, the game of pledges, the game we play with people on the Patreon page where they try to stump us by sending us a number. And we're trying to work out what the number means and how it relates to cricket. And the incentive, what's in it for us, aside from looking into cricket history, is that it's a way of supporting the show. They send the number in the form of dollars and cents to Patreon to support the show. It's a perfect storm, nerdery and subscription at the same time. Nerd Pledge, we're just doing a couple of numbers briefly today, the first of which came in from Simon Koslina. The number was $2.04, and the hint from Simon was that when he was a player, he was cumulatively a captain, a wicketkeeper, and an opening batsman. Adam?
Well, a man who captained Australia, who kept for Australia and opened the batting for Australia periodically was Adam Gilchrist, which was my first thought. Of course, he didn't open the batting in Test cricket, but his 204 came.
He batted number 3. A couple of times.
Yeah, I mean, he would occasionally be used to play that role in the second innings. He may have opened, he might have opened a couple of times when they were chasing quick declaration runs.
Did he bat 3? I think he batted three in India when he made a king pair, like when he made a golden duck in each innings. I think one of those was an elevation to number three when he got out for naught. I think maybe it was in that sequence. There was definitely a king pair in that series, and he batted a three at one point in that series, and it didn't work.
When he did make runs, we remember well that double hundred at the Wanderers in 2002, which at the time...
At the Wanderers. He got around.
So, I mean, you know, emphatic, crazy innings, bombastic innings and all the rest. What I kind of found interesting about this was I knew in the back of my mind that he only held the mantle for the quickest double hundred in Test cricket for a little while. I didn't realise just for how small that window was. So he plays that innings on the 23rd of February 2002. And Nathan Astle, who goes on to not just break that world record, but kind of Usain Bolt at Beijing, break the world record. So Gilchrist's 200 comes from 212 balls, and then Nathan Astle gets there in 153 balls. But that's on the 16th of March in the same year. It's like a few weeks later. I mean, you know... Yeah. You know, I like that, Jeff, when things happen in close succession. Mm. In the past, we've had a few of those. But, yeah, it's quite the record. But what I'm mostly interested in from that, and maybe Nathan Astle, I don't think he... Did he ever keep for New Zealand, Nathan Astle? He used to bowl. I don't think he did. So that, I mean...
He used to bowl little seamers.
Yeah, I knew he bowled, but I'm kind of got in the back of my mind that he might have kept a couple of times, but I doubt that.
I mean, it's New Zealand. Probably everybody's kept at some point.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like it's a fairly versatile setup most of the time.
But would we agree that it's probably Gilchrist? Although now that I've seen that clue, which I didn't see before, the captain thing throws me a bit. If we're talking about a captain that's made 204, I doubt that would be the first way I would describe Adam Gilchrist. And indeed, I don't know whether I'd describe him as an opening batsman either. I mean, I know that he was in white ball cricket, but normally when with...
No, I think that's it. I think that Simon Coslina has said, look, I kept and I opened, and Adam Gilchrist did all of those three things, and in that way we are kindred spirits. I mean, if you think of Adam Gilchrist, you think of him as a one-day opener. That's one of the most prominent ways you'd think of him.
Yeah, okay.
And you do think of him as he's the captain who won that test series in India, the final frontier, and all the rest of it when Ponting was injured. They're all integral parts of the Gilchrist story. So I think the 204, I mean, that was that's almost the pinnacle of Gilchrist, the test batsman. That's when you go, like, holy shit, the way that this guy can turn games around and dominate them is just beyond belief from number seven.
Okay, you've convinced me. Thank you, Simon Coslina. $2.04. We've got Adam Gilchrist at the Wanderers in 2002.
Our next number from Hugh Kenny Herbert, who has taken a hammer to the piggy bank and sent us the ridiculous amount of $19.97.
Wow.
And when I saw 1997, I thought, is that a calendar reference? Is it a year reference? Or is it something more obscure? But Hugh also sent a clue, and his clue was that it involved a run chase. And I knew if there was a run chase and if it was in 1997, there is only one thing it could be. And it is one of the things dearer to the heart of Adam Collins than almost anything else. The thing that made Mark Waugh say, you know more about my career than I do.
Yeah.
Stop asking me questions.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I've told this story on the show before, but I sat down with Mark Waugh in Jamaica before the 2015 test match there. So kind of I was doing like a 20-year retrospective on his Sabina Park epic, and the other one that kind of sits next to it is what he did in Port Elizabeth 2 years on in that wonderful chase when they managed to pick up a victory against South Africa, making 271 in the fourth innings, which may not sound that impressive, but you look at the scorecard across the entirety of the test match. South Africa were all out 209, then Australia were all out 108, then South Africa were all out 168. I mean, you're heading towards one of those incredibly low scoring affairs, and then Australia managed to somehow get to 271, and they should have got there perhaps a fraction easier than that. Mark Waugh gets out to Jack Callis when they're 258. There's still 13 runs to get, and Michael Bevan gets out, I think, next ball, who he'd been batting with for a little while before that. So it ends up being Ian Healy who walks in and smacks that massive six, which is most memorable, to get Australia the win. And Warne gets out in that sequence as well. So it's
Gillespie batting at the end after taking key wickets when they bowled out South Africa cheaply the second time.
That's right.
The top three.
That's right.
And they were in position to... they should have been in a much worse position because I think both the openers were in the 40s at that point. And was it Ali Barker and Gary Kirsten?
Yep, that's it.
Opening in that game?
Adam Barker. Adam Gillespie Barker, the son of Ali.
Adam Barker, sorry. Yes. Would have been good if Ali had the bads on. Yeah, they were both 40-odd when Gillespie came out and knocked them over and then got another one as well. Was it McMillan?
Daryl Cullinan.
It's
Cullinan. It's the other wicket that Gillespie gets in that stretch.
Yep.
And then the other part of that is that this was the brief window. I mean, it didn't last for long, but when Michael Bevan was a serious test bowler, so his analysis in the second innings is 13 overs, 3 maidens, 3 for 18. So basically cleaning up the lower order, but including the wickets of Hansi Cronier and Brian McMillan. And I mentioned before that, you know, Michael Bevan gets derided as an insufficient test batsman, but 24 off 62 balls and batting for an hour and a half with Mark Waugh in a chase where the second highest score was Matthew Elliott with 44. But you go back through the three innings, Adam Barker top score with 48 in the third innings. In Australia's first innings, no one made more than Elliott's 23. And in South Africa's first innings, McMillan top scored with 55. So a very low scoring affair. Bevan was really important too. There's a bit in Mark Waugh's, I think it's in that pretty ordinary book that he put out in 2002. Not one of the better cricketers' biographies, that one. Although I did buy the promotional life-size cardboard cutout of that at Bay 13 in the 2002 one dayer for 4 beers. The bloke who had it, who I did know, I must admit, but I said to him, I need to have that. I need to own that. What's the going rate? And he said, can you buy us 4 beers? I'm like, yeah, sold. So I came back and I took Mark Waugh home with me that night. And to this day, it sits in my parents' shed in Birragara. And it was attended my 21st birthday party. It's been to a lot of things, the Mark Waugh, the Mark Waugh cardboard cutout. But Mark Waugh talks in that shitty book about hearing Bohemian Rhapsody over and over again by the St. George's Park band. Now, Jeff, the more I think about that, the less likely I think that is an accurate recollection from Mark Waugh. As we know, we've heard the you and I have listened to the St. George's Park band quite a bit, and they're not the sort of band that would play Bohemian Rhapsody. Indeed, you don't know really any of their songs apart from Stand By Me. You don't know their songs because they're
band improvisations.
They're band improv stuff, yeah. So I don't think that...
And they're brass band stuff. And what they certainly don't do is play the same song over and over again. They're not the Barmy Army.
No.
They're not like the most ridiculously over-celebrated and under-delivering fan interaction in the world with their like two songs. They play all day. They've got a whole range of music. You know, maybe it was different back then. Maybe in 1997 there was an unimaginative band leader, but I can't really imagine. Maybe it's just that Mark Waugh doesn't know how music goes, and he just thinks every song is Bohemian Rhapsody. Like, as soon as you start playing something, he's like, is this a real life? Is this just fantasy?
Well, yeah, I'm tipping that the scope of music he might have listened to in that time when he was playing for Australia mightn't have extended far beyond that. But yeah, he made 116, batted for 323 minutes. And when I was younger and I used to care more about Mark Waugh's legacy as a batsman, this is the innings I'd come back to time and time again. And I'd go, oh, he's fucking soft, you know, not as good as his brother. I'd go, but look at Port Elizabeth, fourth innings.
What about Port Elizabeth?
I mean, I don't do that now because I don't care anymore. But as a younger man, I did a lot. And if you want to read why I care so much, there's an article in The Cricketer from 5 years ago, which I spent like 6 weeks on and probably no one's ever read. But I promise you, I cared a lot. Don't anymore. Mark Waugh, yeah. Port Elizabeth.
I did like the point when Mark Waugh was asked to name his autobiography and he couldn't tell you what the title was because he'd never read it. Anyway, that is the end of Nerd Pledge for today. If you'd like to join in Nerd Pledge by sending us a number, you just go to patreon.com/thefinalword. You can sign up to support the show to whatever extent or duration you would like, and your number will go on our list and we will come to it in the show or on story time on the weekends where we do more numbers more deeply.
Jeff, we have another set piece on The Final Word, which we do from time to time, and I think today might be a good time for it. What do you say?
I say happy birthday, Sachin.
Sachin.
It's your birthday. Happy birthday,
Sachin. Sachin.
It's your birthday. Happy birthday,
Sachin.
Take it away, Jeff.
Happy birthday, Sachin. Look, it's been a month. I've been remiss in my happy birthday, Sachin, duties because I've been a bit busy with other things. I sent off the full manuscript a couple of days ago with all the corrections and edits done, and so I'm now free to delve back into Sachin Tendulkar's online presence and find out what he's been doing on the internet and who he's been wishing happy birthday to. There's quite a crop, given that it's been a few weeks. So a lot of Indian cricketers, as usual. Deepti Sharma and Jemima Rodrigues of the women's team have got a gong.
Oh, good.
Tino Best for the West Indies, bit of international representation. I'd love to see the selection criteria. Curran Pollard and Tino Best are the only Windies players I've seen repped in the last few months. Don Bradman got one. He's the only dead person to get a happy birthday. So the Don works in a special echelon above other cricketers, that he still gets a happy birthday even though he has departed this mortal coil back in 2001, just before the series in India that we mentioned earlier.
They were over there, weren't they? They were over in, it was just before the just before the first test at Mumbai, yeah.
When they steamrolled India by an innings in the first test, and nobody knew that that would be the last of the 16 wins in a row by Australia.
I think isn't the Wanka Day, work, rest and play, stadium one of the many with a Don Bradman stand as well, if I recall correctly, which is where they were playing that week?
I hope so. I mean, these are the beautiful idiosyncrasies of the game in India. It's entirely plausible. Mohammed Shami got a birthday gong from Sachin, as did his fast bowling colleague Ishant Sharma. And I particularly like, here's a bit of wordplay from Sachin, the little master, likes to get involved in the punnery. Now, you may be aware that the word shanti in Hindi means peace. And if you take the I from the end of shanti and put it on the start, it makes Ishant. And so Sachin says, your bowling doesn't allow the batsman to play in shanti.
Oh, Sachin.
Many happy returns of the day, Ishant. Ah, beautiful work from Sachin, straight out of the middle, straight down the ground. That's gorgeous. There's some actors always get a gong as well. So Sunil Shetty and Chinjari Connadella have got a happy birthday. And professional rich guy Amit Bhatia has got one as well. When you've got enough money, you get one from Sachin. Lots of praise for COVID workers, lots of stuff around Independence Day, MS Dhoni's retirement, as you'd expect. And probably my three faves from the last month. A good congratulations to the Indian chess team.
Oh, good.
For some sort of victory, or maybe it was a draw with Russia that let them both be champions. I haven't investigated that thoroughly, I'll be honest. There's a truly terrible painting of Sachin by a school kid whose eager, proud parent has tweeted it, and Sachin's reposted it saying it's beautiful. That's very generous from him, considering the standard at play. It's not as bad as the Stuart Broad painting from 2013, but, you know, it's... It'd be on the podium at this point. And he's also doing some spawn cons, some sponsored stuff with a solar power company, which is, it's good to see some ecological responsibility in the spawn cons from Sachin to make sure some of his money is coming from the right place.
Does he put hashtag ad at the end, which I often see on Instagram from that stuff, or does he take it as assumed that we're going to work it out?
I think he takes it as assumed. Apparently, they've had a partnership for something like 10 years, so they've been in early. Sachin was solar-powered, of course. He stood in the sun for about 600 days of international cricket, and that's what powered him to go on and make all the runs. So those are the hits, the highlights, and the celebrations from Happy Birthday, Sachin, for this maybe month. We'll see when it's back.
Jeff, speaking of SponCon, we should take a break. But when we come back, rest assured, we will have a lightning round. Lots of other stuff to get to on this weekly edition of The Final Word. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Hi, I'm Dave Warner, and you're listening to The Final Word.
Let's start by agreeing that most sports writing is junk. There's a lot of trash. A lot of it's boring. A lot of it is about hamstrings. Not a lot of people get into the depth, the detail, the real interest of the stories. What is this? Why is sport in our life? Why do we love it? Cricket has more of it than some, but the publication in cricket that does it more and better than any is The Night Watchman. The Night Watchman is a quarterly publication. That means for people who are confused about monthly publications, it comes out once a quarter. That is four times a year, which means that it's less often than a monthly. It's a more solid book-like production. It's come out quarterly for 7 years. They've done 30 issues, 600 stories, 1.5 million words. And in that time, they try to write about the interesting things, the things that don't get written about the rest of the time, the not obvious stories, the off-Broadway things, the off-track, the off-piste, the ideas that wander off into the cricketing wilderness. And what the Night Watchmen have done now is they've assembled a collection of Australiana, cricket writing about or relating to or touching on Australia, not necessarily all by Australians, but all relating to Australia and cricket in some way. And this is what they've put together, and this is what they're releasing now.
Yeah, I think this is a really good idea. So when the Night Watchmen started back in 2013, the view was that they wanted to make it big enough and effectively be a global publication with contributors from all over the world, not just the UK. And the fact that there's enough Australian cricket writing now to justify an edition all on its own, it validates that and speaks to that. And I'm not just saying Australian writers, of course. I mean, whilst people like ourselves, of course, and I see Christian Ryans in this edition as well, who of course, wrote the definitive book about Kim Hughes, which was recently voted Wisden Cricket Monthly's greatest cricket book ever. It's had many gongs over the years, but the best cricket book ever, it's quite the gong. But no, it's other writers as well, like reflecting on the Australian game. So in this case, I mean, there's Lawrence Booth, there's Jonathan Liu, who wrote the essay about the Shane Warne mural that you have to see to believe. It is, without a doubt, the funniest piece of cricket writing I've ever happened upon. We had Jonathan on the Final Word playing Nerd Pledge Quids with us a few months ago. But just imagine Shane Warne, Jason Gillespie, and a time machine, which goes...
Surely was a hot tub.
Which goes on account of how quickly Warne spins the ball. Well, that's how you get his mural brought to life by him. And you'll see that in this edition of The Night Watchman as well. So it's pretty cool. Jeff, there's a bunch of other good writing in here as well. I'll let you rattle off a few of them. But the idea of it is that through The Final Word and Night Watchman, we're working collaboratively to give you a percentage off to make sure that there's an incentive there to pick up this new edition of the mag. It's a digital edition. It's not a hard copy of the book. It's purely a digital edition. So, and hopefully it'll whet the appetite and you'll read this and you'll want to become a subscriber long term, that you've got a sense for what The Night Watchman's all about.
There's a whole lot in this edition. The line leading Australian players, Donald Bradman, may have heard of him, and Betty Wilson in the women's game feature prominently. Interestingly, there's a piece from Bill Ponsford's granddaughter, Megan, who wrote a thought-provoking article for this collection. There's an original song from Neil Hannon. There's a whole stack of other stuff, about 40 pieces in there all told.
I've got a piece in there with Jim Maxwell, which I'm extremely proud of, and not many people have read, I think, because it was kind of part of this TMS compilation 4 or 5 years ago. So I'm glad this is getting another run for my part, because it's something like, you know, I love Jim and you love Jim and all the rest, and I think a lot of Australian cricket fans feel very close to Jim. But reading his story, his backstory as it relates to Test Match Special, I think people will enjoy an awful lot. What was the piece that you wrote that's in this edition?
I've got the 6,000-word psychoanalysis of David Warner, which I think holds up pretty well. I think it still stands up today when I think back over what's in it. Now, what you can get for listening to the show is a 10% off. Look, it's only £5 to begin with, but you can get 10% off that if that is important to you. You go to a bit.ly address, as in bit.ly. Then you add a slash, then you add NW Aussie, and then you'll get to a page where you can buy it. You put in the coupon TFW10 and you get your discount of 10% off. All of that will be in the show notes, so you don't need to memorize it or scribble it down on your hand right now. Just click in the text under the episode and the link will be there and the code will be there, and there'll also be a link and a code to get 20% off the Best of the Night Watchmen, where they did a selection of their best writing over their entire history. So you can get that one for 20% off in print or digital too. So it's pretty economical to get a whole collection of excellent cricket writing if that's your bag. And if you're listening to this show, it probably is. Stop denying it. It's your bag. Just be forthright. It's time to face the truth. Well, this is The Final Word with Jeff Lemon and the somehow still awake Adam Collins. It's time for the lightning round, which means we'll try to move through it as briskly as possible so that Adam can get 2 hours sleep before his infant daughter wakes him with screaming and possibly projectile fluids from one orifice or another. Who knows how it's going to go around? It's party time in the Collins household at any point. There's a whole lot of stuff stewing around with the Australian domestic schedule. We still don't actually know what it is going to look like. So we're kind of holding fire on that until we have some things confirmed on it. But there will be more on that in the next week or so. We do know that the Big Bash and the WBBL are going ahead. We've got the Women's Big Bash fixtures and a hub announced for that tournament after the series with New Zealand. So at least that's one concrete bit that we've got to go forward on. They're playing it all in Sydney, isn't it?
Yeah, they're going to use those grounds. Well, the grounds that we've been accustomed to in the Women's Big Bash over the years. And that makes a lot of sense, really. I mean, they're just kind of ripping the Band-Aid off, really, aren't they? They wanted to take it around as a travelling road show. And maybe that's what will happen with the Big Bash. We're unclear about how that will land. But what we do know is that they're out recruiting, as you would. There are a lot of clubs out there who want to get good players in. I know there is a trade period for the BBL because last year I think there was one trade and they put a media release out to tell us about the one trade and trade period. But there was a trade confirmed, yet, as opposed to, I mean, Australian rules football, where it's a sort of a 3-week exercise in bashing your head against the wall. But Billy Stanlake is moving to the Melbourne Stars. He's been traded for Dan Worrell, who's moving off to the Adelaide Strikers. So that's not for nothing. There's a bunch of gun England white ball players who want to come out, which I think is a good thing. We saw Joss Butler and Joe Root come out 2 years ago. Well, this time around, Johnny Bairstow is keen to come, and apparently he's been linked to the Melbourne Stars. Jason Roy, David Milan, who we spoke about earlier in the show about his recent fantastic T20 form for England, but they're all keen. And Jeff, perhaps bigger than all of that, is Yuvraj Singh. He wants to become the first Indian to play in the Big Bash. Of course, he's finished his broader commitments with the national team, and he's a gun for hire in the T20 comps around the world. But historically, they've not been issued NOCs from India to come to play in Australia. But Yuvraj feels confident that he'll be able to obtain one of those, which will see him in the competition, which will be obviously great news in a comp that needs this injection of talent, as we talked to Trent Woodhill about this time last week.
My understanding of it is that he's wrapped up in the IPL as well. He's not going to continue playing there, and so that means he doesn't need permission from the Indian board anymore, but they do still have that kind of sway, right? That if a player is still in the IPL, so like MS Dhoni still playing in the IPL, still can't play Big Bash without Indian board permission. So really that's them trying to hoard their intellectual property and not give any of the value in their players away to other leagues. And so you have to be completely done with Indian cricket professionally before you could come out. But yeah, it'd be interesting if Yuvraj could. I think it would still be a big deal because he's still beloved in India, and there'd certainly be an amount of attention that would follow him here.
Yeah, and look, I think the BBL in... There was a view that the BBL got beyond the point of needing novelty players. Like, remember the early days, like Shane Warne played, Murali was playing probably beyond the point where he was quite at that stage of his career. And you know, Kevin Peterson, how long he played for, arguably, it was kind of all wrapped up in the idea that it was a sort of a TV show and it was on every night on Channel 10 and whatever. And then there was a view that the BBL had outgrown all of that. Well, maybe it hadn't outgrown it, and maybe this will help. Even if Yuvraj is over the hill and, you know, probably closer to 40 than he is 35 at the moment. But yeah, that'd be an exciting new avenue for the competition to explore if they can start getting some Indian players over. Speaking of the IPL, we finally have the fixtures, Jeff. Only 2 days later than they promised this time around. We were told we were getting them Friday. They ended up coming out on Sunday. The first game on Saturday, the 19th of this month, will be between the Mumbai Indians and the Chennai Super Kings. It's going to be, as we said last week, Jeff, it's going to be a pretty interesting competition played behind closed doors in the UAE. The quarantining is going to be a big part of this conversation. They're talking about, as we expected, and indeed I think you foreshadowed a couple of months ago, they're going to fly them out in a charter flight to the UAE, all the players in this current series. I think there are 10 of the 21 Australian players, and roughly the same out of the England squad, about half of the England squad, who will be heading out to the UAE for that. But it means they'll miss anywhere between 1 and 3 games because they're not being allowed to, you know, kind of have the express quarantine that they hope they might have. So, yes, we will see where that all plays out. Who knows what will happen between now and when they get back from there.
So does that mean a week in quarantine if it's 1 to 3 games rather than a fortnight? Or
yeah, I'm not sure how long they're being asked to quarantine for, but I know that it's longer than they were hoping. So that will change things a bit. Another Australian has entered into the IPL this week, actually. Adam Zampa is going to be replacing Kane Richardson, whose wife's having their first child, and he said that he was going to sit out as a consequence. Daniel Sams, I'm not sure if I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, but Daniel Sams is replacing...
You talk about how much having children costs. You know, they're always saying having a kid will cost you X, $500,000 or whatever. This is a kid that's probably cost him $500,000 before it's even come out.
Yeah.
Like, that's a big payday to miss.
I guess the way they would look at it is the way that Kane Richardson's bowling at the moment, he's going to be making a lot of money off the T20 circuit for a long time and thus missing one. Who's to know? But yes, Daniel Sams, who obviously hasn't had a lot to do on this tour so far, he will be replacing Jason Roy at the Delhi Capitals.
Not exactly a like for like, is it?
No, but in saying that, I mean, Sams is highly regarded. From those who know this stuff, and I don't necessarily put myself in this category, those who really understand the numbers of T20 cricket reckon that Sams is going to be a gun. So it'll be interesting to see whether he can force his way into the starting 11 to one of the 4 spots that Delhi have at their disposal for non-Indian players. We briefly touched on this earlier when talking about Dala Zadran, but how many stories are there at the moment, speaking of the Delhi Capitals, how many stories are doing the rounds about Ravi Chandran Ashwin and whether he will or won't mancat? I've just got a feeling, let's call it a prediction, that he's going to do it all the time and it is going to be fucking amazing and he's just going to take this opportunity when there's so much focus on him and this mode of dismissal that he'll be running out every non-striker and he won't give a fuck and it's going to be a real thing. And, you know, we've joked in the past that it's going to take a proliferation of non-strikers being run out in order for them to stay in their crease. There's no other way of the tide turning and maybe Ashwin will choose this competition. I've just got a feeling about it.
I think that what we'll probably see, we certainly saw it after he ran out Butler, if you looked at the before and after of every other player, every other non-striker at his end while he was bowling, was very firmly in the crease. So I think we'll see them paying a lot more attention when he's bowling, but and maybe even just against the Delhi Capitals in general. But I think it takes another player from another team to get on the bandwagon and you know, solidarity, someone else to get in support of the movement for it to become a broader thing across the board rather than you just have to be careful about this when Ashwin's bowling.
Interesting that Ricky Ponting did a follow-up about this last week with Ashwin on his YouTube channel, where Ponting's position now is that, well, maybe there should be a run penalty. So at least we've got over the idea that it should just not be anything at all. But I saw Dave Tickner tweeting about this today saying, if you saw that Zadran example, as if that shouldn't just be a 5-run penalty, it should be an awful lot more than that. Yeah. Andy Zaltzman, again, I've raced him 3 times today, but it's fair to say that Zaltz and I have spent a lot of time together in the last 5 nights. He was mooting an interesting idea around this earlier, that maybe if your non-striker false starts, and of course the third umpire will have that ability to see that you won't be permitted to score runs off the ball. So it's like a batting no ball. So if that might be one way of providing an incentive inside the game, that with the third umpire toggling away on the front foot no ball, as they will be into the future thanks to the recently announced reforms, they could also be watching for the non-striker. And if they break, I don't think this is the best way of doing it, but it is an option that you're barred from scoring runs from that ball. So interesting suggestion.
Right, there. So that becomes a delivery, but a scoreless delivery.
Yeah. So if you're hit for 6,
yeah.
That's, oh, six, sorry, guys. Out. Unfortunately, it's a dot ball
because the non-striker was out of the ground. Yeah.
Yeah.
All of this stuff, I think, is just over trying to find a solution for something that already has a really simple solution. And I think it's looking at it the wrong way because it's looking at it as it's not cheating for the non-striker to be out of their ground. It's a legitimate tactical decision. They can make a decision to back up by 4 meters if they want to take the risk. But that's how it should be. It should be a choice that carries a risk and carries a possibility of profit. And if you have those two things into the equation, then that's the tension that makes sport interesting, not having a hard and fast rule that then has to have people with, you know, micro granular replays saying, was there some bit of his boot behind the line before the ball had fully left the bowler's hand or whatever it is. It's overcomplicating it when it doesn't need to be.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. The jeopardy is sufficient as it is, but if we're, I mean, if the debate gets to the point where we're going to be talking about fucking run penalties and so on, then maybe this is not a bad thing to have, at least in the conversation. Usman Khawaja, Jeff, we haven't talked about Uzi in a while, but he's been talking about his own prospects of late. Interesting interview with Cricket Australia during the week. He spoke to the website. Not often you hear a player as forthright as Usman about his dumping from international cricket, which is now a year ago this week, I should add, noting that he did call Justin Langer after he was left out of that extended squad of 26 for this tour and kind of gave him a piece of his mind, but equally that he felt satisfied after talking to Langer that the door isn't completely shut on him to play again. He says that he's been dumped and dropped and left out of so many teams over the years, albeit sort of more when he was younger than in the last 5 years when he's been pretty consistently in and around squads. But he made a ton for his grade club this week to start the new season in Queensland. He believes that he would have been on standby if an opener had got injured for this tour. But yeah, I think that, look, at least he's sufficiently happy to talk about the outcome of that conversation with Langer, that he feels like he's in a good place to push for national selection. And I think that's a good thing, that a player of his capacity isn't sort of saying, oh, well, I've been dropped, I've had it, that's it, I've cracked the shits. He's taking a good attitude to, I mean, unlikely as it is that he'll be recalled, but he's taking the right approach rather than sort of just diminishing his reputation by being bitter about the whole situation.
I suppose there's not a lot else you can do as a player. There's no point cracking it. There's no point giving angry interviews. You know, it's not going to help your reputation. It's not going to help you get other jobs, even if you're not getting back into the national team. But there is still that lingering thing that he's a player who is pretty hard done by in 50-over cricket, especially given that basically being dropped from the test team meant that he was then out of the one-day team by association, even though he was, you know, top three in their vote-getters for that year in terms of the best one-day international players, you know, had the most runs in the world coming into the 2019 World Cup, and then had not a terrible test series, you know, played three sort of ordinary tests, but he did have a couple of innings that had an influence in there, particularly at Edgbaston, where that 40 he made supporting Smith was important in the second innings there. So, you know, he didn't have a complete washout of a series. He just wasn't making big scores. And so obviously, you know, he was a reasonable person to make way when Smith needed to come back in. But that shouldn't have spelt the end of his one-day cricket necessarily, but it basically did. You know, Marnus got into that one-day team really on the back of his test work, and Khawaja was out of the one-day team on the back of his test work. So, look, going back to him in test cricket, he's had a long, long time in test cricket and has, you know, rarely delivered fully on his potential. So whether there's much upside in getting him back into the test team, I don't know, but I think what he did in one day cricket showed that he has that capacity.
Yeah, I think if you go back at that decision to leave him out during the Ashes last year for Marnus, it's hard to evaluate that decision as anything other than spot on, which is just one of those things sometimes, right? Like, you're right that being dropped when he was, you know, after Leeds, you think it's a bit stiff, really, given the way that he started 2019. Yeah, that 100 at Canberra didn't amount to much, and yes, he didn't have the best summer when India were out there, but he was essentially a senior player. It takes a lot to drop a senior player, and Marnus Labuschagne is a lot, isn't he? I mean, by any definition, he is a lot. And now he's the established number three with Smith at number four, and that's the role Khawaja was playing, and kind of, you know, the show moves on. But at least he has had that sort of show of faith from Langer that it's not kind of like it was with Shaun Marsh last year when he was, by the sounds of things, told more along the lines of, it doesn't really matter how many runs you make from here, we've moved on from you. So who knows? It's not as though Khawaja is too old to be reconsidered again. What is he, 33 or 34 possibly? Yeah. I mean, there's some pretty recent examples of players getting opportunities after the age of 35. So watch this space on that. One player who we won't see again, Jeff, he played his final innings of first-class cricket today, Ian Bell. the last link to the 2005 Ashes campaign. A lot to be said about Ian Bell's career, really. I mean, a member of that 05 Ashes winning team, didn't make a lot of runs in that series. As he says himself, he wasn't ready for it in 05, but the experience he garnered from 05 was such an important part of him going on to win 5 Ashes series, which I think only 3 Englishmen have done, if I recall correctly. He made 3 centuries in 3 winning test matches in 2013, which was really his golden summer. He was still making runs in 2015, for that matter, as well. Important runs in that victory at Edgbaston, which meant that England won that test match. Jeff, you saw him play at his peak, really, in that 2013 series, and perhaps the most elegant cover drive of his generation, certainly as far as England players are concerned. And, yeah, as I said at the top, 5 Ashes wins speaks for itself.
Yeah, him in that 2013 series, every time Australia was in a position to press the advantage, there was Ian Bell, and it disappeared. And that was definitely his finest hour. I saw some numbers that I think he lost more Ashes test matches than he won, but still managed to have those 5 winning series. He would have had about a dozen wins, a dozen won matches in those 5 series where they were winning sort of 2-1 or scorelines like that, but also had the 2-5-0s in Australia that meant he ended up sort of losing more tests than he won, but won the series that he won, you know, by dint of that kind of hard-playing cricket that they managed to turn out in England, where they, it was 2-1 in 2009, it was 2-1 in 2005, and 3-1 in Australia in 10-11. So, you know, even though they weren't wiping the floor with Australia in those series, they were getting the wins.
Yeah, and I think that, well, he's 38 years of age as he puts the cue in the rack. He hasn't played international cricket since 2015, of course, but so he did sort of get pensioned off at a relatively young age for a guy that played, 118 test matches by the end of his stretch in red ball cricket from 2004. So he played for 11 years, made over 7,000 runs, 22 centuries. And, yeah, that last playing connection, I think, was what most people felt, I think, from 2005. Every player from that wonderful series has now retired. Now, of course, some of them retired a long time ago and have gone on to do a number of things in their lives outside of the game and so on. But Bell was that constant, always there, even when it was all over. He made a half century for Warwickshire today to finish it. 9 boundaries on the way to 50, which is very Ian Bell. But well played.
Yeah.
He's, I think, you know, one of the genuinely lovely players to watch, and you put aside partisan interest and so on, and a player that I think we enjoyed watching as an Australian because he did it the right way. So the end of a very long and very much celebrated career.
And I do think that if he had stayed in that England team for another 4 or 5 years, that they wouldn't have been a weaker side for it.
No, probably not. Probably not.
I think that brings us to the end of the show today. You need to go to bed, and I need to get on with my day.
Yeah, it is 3 a.m. It's 3:09 and 46, 47, 48, 49 seconds, which is later
seconds
than...
Seconds never stop counting.
Yeah, I don't think it's been as late as that for me recording an episode of The Final Word for quite a long time, but it's been worth it. As I said off the top, it's not about my energy levels. It's about the preparation we do beforehand, or so I like to believe. And we're going to have loads to talk about next week as well on the weekly show, because I'll be talking to Alison Mitchell in a socially distanced way, but it'll be our first proper face-to-face interview for 6 months. That, by the way, it's 6 months today since the World Cup final. It was International Women's Day 6 months ago when Australia won.
The past tense is when.
Yes. I was going to re-record that, but hey, let's go with that. Since they won the World Cup final at the MCG in front of 87,000 people. So this fucking nightmare has been going for 6 months now, is another way of interpreting that. But yes, Ali Mitchell will be our first chat in the flesh since then. That'll be next week. Between times, there'll be more story time on the weekend, which we're having so much fun with. If you haven't had a chance to catch up with that, I loved listening back to the show, which I don't always feel that way when I listen back to what we've recorded. I can sometimes feel a bit anxious about the whole thing, but last week's was particularly good, and as was the Pat Cummins interview from last year. I forgot how funny he was that day. Not that I didn't think he's a funny guy, but more that he was on top form when we spoke to him in Derby last year. So if you want to revisit our chat with Pat and our story time musings, you can find that in the feed from last weekend. We'll do it all again next weekend. And Jeff, we're very grateful to a lot of people for keeping the show on the road each week.
The Final Word is produced by Bad Producer Productions, edited by Dave Collins, and put out by Jay Mueller and Astrid Edwards at that aforementioned production company each week. Everybody who supports the show on Patreon makes it possible to keep it going in the way that we're doing twice a week. We appreciate you. We see you. We are you, really. We're all one organism, aren't we? We're all just expressions of energy in one conglomerate mass. And everybody who rates and reviews the show on various platforms or sends it around to their friends, we appreciate you too.
I just want to put another shout out for the Night Watchmen. They've done a really good thing with this Australian edition. So if you've been kind of on the brink of getting involved with Night Watchmen in the past, this is a very, very good time to have a look. You'll see all that information in the show notes. And thanks to CBUS Super. You know, I don't think we thank them enough sometimes, because without them laying a foundation under what we're doing, it would be very tough for us to have a podcast. And the fact that we've got CBUS and of course, these wonderful patrons of ours, it has made such a huge difference over the last 6 months. And we've had perhaps our most productive period ever of recording, which is strange considering it's been a middle of a pandemic and guests haven't been as easy to come by, but it's been great as well.
It's the final word. Jeff Lemon, Adam Collins will be back for story time on the weekend and for our weekly show next week with more tales of daring do and wonder from the cricketing world. Until then, stay safe.
Bye.